All right. Well, good evening, everyone. It is so good to see all of you. I am so excited to see so many people coming out just to think really carefully about their faith. We're going to follow the same structure that we did last time. So I'm going to break this into two parts. We're going to spend the first half looking at one argument. I'll give you a chance to ask questions at the end of that. I've got a short video I'll show you that's going to kind of recap what we've done. And then we'll look at a second argument and we'll do the same thing there. I'll show you a short video and then we'll do some question and answer. I want to quickly review what we did last time. So last time we saw that we know the truth of Christianity through the self-authenticating witness of the Holy Spirit. And this is really important because what that means is that we can know Christianity is true even if we can't show that it's true. And apologetics, what we're doing tonight and what we did last week and what we're going to do next week, though apologetics helps us show that it's true. We are looking at three arguments for the existence of God. In fact, let me just quickly summarize here. So we're looking at arguments for theism. And the first argument we looked at was an answer to the question, why did the universe begin? And this was the Kalam cosmological argument. I have a copy of William Lane Craig's book, On Guard. I'd like to give it out to somebody tonight. And so if there's anyone here who thinks that they, without looking at their notes from memory, could give us the arguments from infinity. No, I'm just kidding. If you could give us just the Kalam cosmological argument, just the three or the two premises and the conclusion. Is there anybody who thinks they could do it, would like to do it, and earn this book here? We got, okay, yeah. Miss Elmer. Excellent. Great job. Oh. All right, so the two arguments we're going to look at tonight, one is the fine-tuning argument, and it's aimed at answering this question, why is the universe fine-tuned for life? The second argument that we're going to look at is the moral argument, and it's going to answer the question, can we be good without God? So I want to start with the fine-tuning argument. And to help us think about this, I want to give you an illustration here. So suppose you're out in the woods and you find this beautiful painting, one of my favorite paintings. You find this out in the woods. What's the best explanation for the existence of this painting? Well, the best explanation is going to be that somebody painted this and somehow it ended up in the woods where you are. Is it possible that through some random natural processes, this painting came to exist? Is that possible? I mean, yeah, it is like theoretically possible, but it's so unlikely that that's not a real option, right? For someone to say, wow, I mean, that just randomly happened to come to exist is not going to be a good answer. And what we're going to see then tonight is that the fine-tuning argument says the same thing goes for our universe. That's what we're going to be looking at. So here's the argument. So first premise, the fine-tuning of the universe is due either to necessity, chance, or design. And I'm going to explain what fine-tuning is in just a minute here. So the fine-tuning of the universe is due either to necessity, chance, or design. Second premise of the argument says, well, it's not due to necessity or chance. Well, that leaves us with just one option. The option is design. So the conclusion is, therefore, the fine-tuning of the universe is due to design. We're going to look at this argument more carefully tonight, but first I just want to go back over the logical structure of this argument. This is what's called a valid argument. A valid argument, what that means is it's impossible for the premises to all be true and for the conclusion to be false. That is, if premises one and two are true, the conclusion has got to be true. It's impossible for it to be false while those premises are true. So because the structure of this argument is good, That means what we need to do is ask, well, are these premises true? Should we accept these premises? And so I want to go through these premises and look at why we should accept these premises. So let's look at the first premise and support for that. So support for premise one. What exactly is it that we mean by fine-tuning? Well, here's the definition I've got for you for your notes. Fine-tuning means that given the laws of nature, the fundamental constants and initial conditions of the universe are just right for life, and had they differed ever so slightly, the universe could not support life. That's what it means to say that the universe is fine-tuned for life. There's a narrow range of possible constants and quantities that the universe could have had that are life-sustaining. And we happen to fall within that narrow range. All right, so what do we mean by fundamental constants? Well, these are going to be unchanging quantities in the mathematical equations that express laws of nature. And we're going to look at an example of one of these in just a second. What are the initial conditions? Well, these are going to be the starting values and arbitrary quantities of the early universe that the laws of nature operated on. So if you know anything about equations of physics, right, you've got your variables and you've got to enter values in for those variables. Well, these are the variables that went in for the beginning of the universe. So before we look at some examples of fine-tuning and I walk you through this, I want to give you an illustration that comes from John Barrow. He's an English physicist. Here's what he says. He says, take a white screen here and imagine our universe. And let's say our universe, we set it down as a blue dot on our screen. So hopefully you can see that dot. So that represents our universe. And since it can support life, we're going to make it a blue dot. He says, okay, now what if we slightly alter one of those constants? That's going to give us a description of another universe. So let's make another dot. If this universe can support life, then we're going to make it blue. If it can't support life, then we're going to make it red. And what he says is you would end up with a sheet that is full of red dots with a single blue dot. Oh. And he says, this is what we're talking about here. It's so incredibly unlikely that our universe could actually support life that we need an explanation to account for that. Why is it that we live in a blue dot universe when it's way more probable that we would be in a red dot universe? So let's look at some examples of fine-tuning. So the first one is the gravitational constant, which is in Newton's law of gravity. And here, this is going to take you back to some of your physics classes. What we've got here is the equation that we use for the attractive force between two objects. And so F is that force of attraction. We've got M1 and M2. Those represent the masses of the objects that we are looking at. R is going to be the distance between those two objects. And then what we've got is G. G is a constant. G is this value, and it's always going to be this value. It doesn't change. That's what a constant is. And it turns out that had the gravitational constant been different in one part by 10 to the power of 60, it wouldn't be possible for there to be life in our universe. Either the universe would have collapsed back in on itself because it was too strong, gravity was too strong, or it would expand so quickly that it wouldn't be possible for there to be stars. So here's what it is. 1 in 10 to the power of 60. And I've been trying really hard all week to try to think about how could I make this value, like, understandable, right? It's so huge that it's really difficult to get our minds around this. So I've got a couple examples here that will hopefully help you understand this a little bit. Let's go back to that screen that I had with all the dots, okay? What if we took this screen just as it is up there? So what is that, about 10 by 10, 10 feet by 10 feet? If we covered the whole Earth with those screens, how many Earths would it take to give us enough dots to get us 10 to the 60? Well, it turns out it would take 7 times 10 to the power of 42 Earths So you're looking at one blue dot amidst 7 times 10 to the power of 42 Earths worth of red dots. That's pretty unlikely. Let me give you another example here. There's estimated to be around 10 to the power of 19 grains of sand on the Earth. All right. So if we were to just have one grain of sand, one part in 10 to the power of 60, what would that look like? Well, that would be one grain of sand among 10 to the power of 41 Earths. That's not really very helpful, actually, right? I mean, we're still looking at these crazy powers. So let me give you one final one. Man, I spent a lot of time this week looking for some really, really good examples. And I think this is, you tell me if you like this one. I think this is the best one. All right, so there's estimated to be about 10 to the power of 51 atoms on the Earth, right? So the Earth has 10 to the power of 51 atoms. What that means then is we would be looking for one atom among atoms in 1 billion Earths. That's incredibly huge, right? I mean, the odds of that are so, so small. And this is for one of the constants, and there's many more constants and many more quantities that we're going to be looking at for the initial conditions. So it's just astronomically improbable. Here's what Paul Davies, he's a physicist and a philosopher, who's, by the way, not a theist. Here's what he says. Scientists are slowly waking up to an inconvenient truth. The universe looks suspiciously like a fix. The issue concerns the very laws of nature themselves. For 40 years, physicists and cosmologists have quietly been collecting examples of all too convenient coincidences and special features of the underlying laws of the universe that seem to be necessary in order for life, and hence conscious beings, to exist. Change any one of them, and the consequences would be lethal. The crucial point is that some of those metaphorical knobs, that is, if we were to vary the constants and arbitrary quantities, of which there are 40, he says, must be tuned very precisely or the universe would be sterile. All right, let me give you another example here. So that was a gravitational constant. Here's the strong nuclear force. This is what binds together neutrons and protons to create atomic nuclei. If it had been stronger or weaker by just 5%, life would be impossible. Or here's another example. The initial amount of disorder or entropy in the early universe. This affects the rate of expansion, right? And this is how ordered is the initial universe, right? How much disorder is present, how much order is present. And this is... So that number we looked at, 10 to the power of 60, is huge. This number is actually much, much bigger. So the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, Roger Penrose, he says, a change of 1 in 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 123 would result in a life-prohibiting universe. He says, that number is so astronomical, he tries to explain to us what this number would be. He says, this extraordinary figure, or this is an extraordinary figure, one could not possibly even write the number down in full. He says, it would be 1 followed by 10 to the power of 123 successive zeros. He says, even if we were to write a zero on each separate portion, or sorry, each separate proton, and on each separate neutron, can you hear me? All right, there we go. We're back. Even if we were to write a zero on each separate proton and on each separate neutron in the entire universe, and we could throw in all the other particles as well for good measure, we would fall short of writing down the figure needed. That is, there aren't actually enough particles in the universe to assign a zero to them to capture that number there. Let me give you some other examples from other leading physicists here. So we've got Sir Martin Rees. Here's what he says. As the start of the 21st century, we have identified 6 numbers that seem especially significant. 2 of them relate to basic forces. 2, fix the size and overall texture of our universe and determine whether it will continue forever. And 2 more, fix the properties of space itself. These 6 numbers constitute a recipe for a universe. Moreover, the outcome is sensitive to their values. If any one of them were to be untuned, that is modified, there would be no stars and no life. Here we've got Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose. Why is the universe so close to the dividing line between collapsing again and expanding indefinitely? In order to be as close as we are now, the rate of expansion early on had to be chosen fantastically accurately. At the rate of expansion of 1 second after the Big Bang, if the rate of expansion 1 second after the Big Bang had been less by 1 part in 10 to the power of 10, the universe would have collapsed after a few million years. If it had been greater by 1 part in 10 to the power of 10, the universe would have essentially been empty after a few million years. In neither case would it have lasted long enough for life to develop. Here we've got Paul Davies again. Neutrons are just a tad heavier than protons. If it were any other way around, atoms couldn't exist because all the protons in the universe would have decayed into neutrons shortly after the Big Bang. No protons, then no atomic nucleus, and no atoms. No atoms, no chemistry, no life. Freeman Dyson, who you see up here, who's a theoretical physicist, he says, there are many lucky accidents in physics. Without such accidents, water could not exist as liquid. Chains of carbon atoms could not form complex organic molecules. And hydrogen atoms could not form breakable bridges between molecules. That is, the basic building blocks of life could not have formed. Here we've got Sir Fred Hoyle. Here's what he says. Some supercalculating intellect must have designed the properties of the carbon atom. Otherwise, the chance of my finding such an atom through the blind forces of nature would be utterly minuscule. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a superintellect has monkeyed with physics, as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. All right, I'm going to give you just one more here. This is Frank Tipler. He's a mathematical physicist, and here's what he says. This is in the preface to his book. Here's what he says. When I began my career as a cosmologist some 20 years ago, I was a convinced atheist. I never, in my wildest dreams, imagined that one day I would be writing a book purporting to show that the central claims of the Judeo-Christian theology are, in fact, true. That these claims are straightforward deductions from the laws of physics as we now understand them. I have been forced into these conclusions by the inexorable logic of my own special branch of physics. And I could really go on and on. I want you to know I'm not cherry-picking quotes here. These are leading physicists, and I've left like some of the best quotes out, actually. This is something that is just widely agreed upon by contemporary physicists, that the universe is fine-tuned for life. And what makes this so compelling is that there aren't just one or two examples, but actually an overwhelming number of these. All right, so let's move on then. What do we mean when we're talking about life? And this is really important here. By life, all we mean is this. We don't mean like human life or carbon-based life or anything like that. What we mean is the property of organisms to take in food, to extract energy from it, to grow, to adapt to their environment, and to reproduce. So here, all we really need is a universe that is stable and can support those sorts of things. That's what we're talking about here. So we're not talking about intelligent life. We're not talking about human life. We're talking about life at all. There's some basic things that need to be true about our universe in order for life to exist in any way whatsoever. All right. So now that we've looked at what fine-tuning is, and we've looked at what life is, now let's look at the different options that could possibly explain fine-tuning. So here, this is our argument. We're still in premise one. So what are the options that are available to account for fine-tuning? Well, the first one is going to be necessity or physical necessity. The idea here is that the constants and quantities of the initial state of the universe must have had the values that they do. They couldn't have been otherwise. It's impossible for the universe not to be a life-sustaining universe. That's what's being said by physical necessity here. There's no way that those constants and quantities could have been any different from what they in fact are. The second possible explanation is chance. This says that the fine-tuning of the universe neither has an explanation nor needs one, right? Sometimes just really lucky things happen. There's a 1 out of 10 to the 60th chance of something happening. Well, sometimes things just happen, and we happen to win the cosmic lottery. We got really, 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 really lucky. That's the chance option. The third option is design. And the design option says the universe was intentionally designed to be life-permitting. Okay, so the argument so far says, all right, the universe is fine-tuned for life. We need an explanation for that. And these are the three possible explanations. If you've got another explanation, feel free to offer it. I think this captures all of them. And we're going to go through now and look at these here. So let's move on to our second premise here. So here we're going to look at support for premise two. So premise two says the fine-tuning of the universe is not due to physical necessity or chance. All right. What this view says, remember, physical necessity, is it's impossible for the universe not to have been a life-supporting universe. And the problem with this is highly implausible. The constants and quantities, this view says, had to be what they are, and they couldn't possibly have been different than what they are. But it turns out that our best evidence suggests that they actually could have been different. These constants and quantities that we're talking about are not determined by the laws of nature. And so the question arises then, what accounts for them? Why is it that they happen to be just the way they need to be in order for there to be life? And someone says, the physical necessity view says, well, they just had to be that way. And the question is, and why exactly did they have to be that way? And there isn't a good explanation for this. Let me give you an illustration of this. Suppose it's my birthday, and I go with my family and friends to the beach. And we come around some rocks, and I see out on the beach spelling out a bunch of rocks arranged that spell, "Happy Birthday, Rick." And I say, oh, wow. Like, how did you guys do this? You were with me the whole time. And they say, oh, we didn't do it. In fact, it was just there. And in fact, it couldn't have been otherwise. It had to be that way. It's impossible for there not to have been those rocks there that said, "Happy Birthday, Rick." Well, that is so unlikely that that's not going to be a good response, right? To say, oh, it had to be that way. It's so improbable that you want to say, no, there's got to be some other explanation. And so this is the problem with the answer of physical necessity. It really seems as though the constants and quantities could have been different. And we don't have any reason to think that they couldn't have been different. And we would actually need a good explanation for why they happen to be just the way they are and could have been no different than they in fact are. So that's the first one. Second issue here has to do with chance. So chance says we got really, really lucky. The problem with this is so incredibly unlikely that it's what's called statistically impossible. So let me give you an illustration. Suppose you are playing poker for money with a bunch of other people, and the person you're playing with, or one of the people you're playing with, gets a royal flush, and in fact gets 10 in a row. Now, I know we're in a Baptist church here, so I'll explain to you how poker works. You get a hand of 5 cards, right, and you're trying to get the best hand. And a royal flush is the best hand that's possible. A royal flush is going to be the highest 5 cards, so that's 10, jack, queen, king, and ace, all of the same suit, so like all spades or something like that. All right, so the chances of getting a royal flush, just one, is one hand in 650,000 hands, okay? Really unlikely. But hey, lucky things happen. So your friend wins and takes the money. And then you play another hand, and they win again with a royal flush. And again, and again, and again. Now, it turns out the odds of winning with 10 royal flushes in a row is 10 to the power of 59. So like 1 in 10 to the power of 59. It's not going to happen, right? And so as your friend is, after his 10th royal flush, right, is like gathering his money and is ready to head out, you say, whoa, hold on. Clearly you were cheating. He says, what are you talking about? Sometimes really lucky things just happen, right? No, don't let him leave. He clearly cheated. Clearly. And that's the issue that we have here with chance. It's so improbable that to say, well, we just happen to get lucky, is not really a live option here. And so this has led some people to posit a different answer. And this is going to be, I call this the Marvel answer. This is the multiverse answer. And the idea here, in fact, let me give it to you. So the multiverse response is going to say this. There are many, many universes that exist, each with a randomly selected set of values. And so on the multiverse response, the idea is, hey, what are the chances that you, just a single person playing the lottery, wins the lottery? Not very much, right? It's very unlikely that you'll win the lottery. But now if enough people play the lottery, it's not unlikely that somebody wins. Somebody's going to win if you get enough people playing. And that's the idea with the multiverse here. They say, well, it's not just one universe. We actually have like a near infinite number of universes. And they've all got these different constants and quantities. And so, of course, one of them at least is going to be one that's life permitting. And so, yes, it's improbable that your specific universe would be just right for life if there's only one. But if there's a whole bunch, it's not very unlikely that at least one of them would be life permitting. That's the multiverse response. There's several problems with the multiverse response. So let me give you the first one. The first problem is that there is no scientific evidence for thinking that there is a multiverse. I know if you love Marvel and you're disappointed, but it's very, very, there's no good evidence at all. No scientific evidence whatsoever that there is a multiverse. In fact, what this looks like is an ad hoc attempt to avoid the design conclusion. Now, what does ad hoc mean? Well, this is a fallacy where someone invents a new, unsupported explanation to avoid being proven wrong. And that's what this looks like here, right? Is to say, oh, well, I don't want that design conclusion, so I'm just going to make up this other thing here. I have no evidence to think it's true, but I'm going to throw it out because I want to avoid this other conclusion. So first, this is unsupported by scientific evidence, and it seems to be ad hoc. But there's bigger problems with it than that. The second issue here is this. How exactly did all of these universes come about? We're going to need a universe generator, something to be producing these universes. In fact, a huge number of them, so that eventually we get a life-permitting universe. And here's the problem. The universe generator itself would need to be fine-tuned. Why is it that it is set up just right to be able to crank out the types of universes that actually could be life-supporting? We need a fine-tuning explanation for the universe generator, if such a thing exists. And so all this answer does then is just push the question back a step. So we're no longer asking, why is our universe fine-tuned for life? We're asking, why is the universe generator fine-tuned for making universes that are fine-tuned for life? Same question, we've just moved up a level. The third problem is what's called the Boltzmann brain problem. And I can't believe I'm going to be talking about Boltzmann brains here at church. So let me tell you about the Boltzmann brain problem. In fact, I'll just read to you what I've got there and then I'll explain what's going on. So it's far more likely that a universe consists of just a single brain that merely has the mental properties of a universe like ours, the mental experience of a universe like ours, than that a universe like ours physically exists in all of its complexity. All right, that probably didn't make any sense. So let me explain this. Let's go back to last week when we looked at one of the reasons I gave for thinking that the universe had a beginning. This had to do with the second law of thermodynamics. And the issue was this. Over time, any system, unless more energy is being put into it, reaches equilibrium. And so what happens is usable energy slowly decreases over time. Now, if our universe had an infinite past, then we would have already reached equilibrium, which means there wouldn't be enough usable energy for us to live and for our solar system to exist in these sorts of things. Well, Rudolf Boltzmann, he had a response to this. And his response was to say, well, actually, you can have equilibrium, and yet you'll still have these small pockets of order that will show up. And it just so happens that what we experience, our solar system, falls within one of these small pockets of order within our broad universe of equilibrium, where everything's spread out. So this was his response. The problem with this is that small pockets of order are much more likely than larger pockets of order. So for example, if I have a bag of Scrabble pieces, and I shake it up, and I dump it out onto the Scrabble board, I'm going to get a mess of pieces, but with some small bits of order throughout, right? I'll have words that are one or two letters long. What I'm not going to get is a large area of order. I'm not going to get something like anti-disestablishmentarianism, right? That's not going to show up on the board. Smaller pockets of order are way more probable and will far outnumber large pockets of order. Okay, where am I going with this? Well, it turns out then that a universe that has these what are called Boltzmann brains, that is, all that exists is a brain that has experiences, like hallucinatory experiences of a world like what we live in, way more likely than an actual world where you've got buildings and you've got solar systems and those sorts of things. Why? Because a single brain requires much less order than a whole solar system like ours. And so the problem is, for Boltzmann, is it turns out if his response is right, it's much more likely that we are just a brain that exists somewhere in the universe that's having an experience of sitting tonight at Candy's Creek listening to this lecture, and none of it's actually happening. That's much more likely than that we really are at a place that really exists in the universe called Candy's Creek, and we're actually listening to this lecture. Because there's way more smaller pockets of order where you're going to have these brains. All right. I think I've probably lost almost everybody here. So how does that apply to the multiverse? Well, here's the idea. With the multiverse, again, the second law of thermodynamics still applies to the multiverse. And so the issue is going to be, it's way more likely that you're going to have these universes that are just going to be a single brain having these experiences, thinking they're with other people and doing things, but none of that's actually happening, than that you're going to have a universe like ours where all of these things really exist and there's multiple observers. And so the issue here is this. If there's a multiverse, then we are probably a single brain hallucinating everything that we're experiencing. And if your theory leads you to that conclusion, that's a serious problem for your theory. If your theory leads you to say, none of this actually exists, all that exists is me, and this is all in my head, that's a serious problem for your view. And that's actually what the multiverse theory leads to. And so we've got really, really good reason to reject this view here. So going back to our argument then, here's what we've got. The fine-tuning of the universe is due either to necessity, chance, or design. But it's not due to necessity or chance. And so therefore, the fine-tuning of the universe is due to design. All right. What I want to do is I want to show you this short video here. It'll summarize what we've just talked about, and then we'll discuss, and I'll give you a chance to ask some questions here.
From galaxies and stars, down to atoms and subatomic particles. The very structure of our universe is determined by these numbers. These are the fundamental constants and quantities of the universe. Scientists have come to the shocking realization that each of these numbers has been carefully dialed to an astonishingly precise value, a value that falls within an exceedingly narrow, life-permitting range. If any one of these numbers were altered by even a hair's breadth, no physical, interactive life of any kind could exist anywhere. There'd be no stars, no life, no planets, no chemistry. Consider gravity, for example. The force of gravity is determined by the gravitational constant. If this constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th parts, none of us would exist. To understand how exceedingly narrow this life-permitting range is, imagine a dial divided into 10 to the 60th increments. To get a handle on how many tiny points on the dial this is, compare it to the number of cells in your body, or the number of seconds that have ticked by since time began. If the gravitational constant had been out of tune by just one of these infinitesimally small increments, the universe would either have expanded and thinned out so rapidly that no stars could form and life couldn't exist, or it would have collapsed back on itself with the same result: no stars, no planets, and no life. Or consider the expansion rate of the universe. This is driven by the cosmological constant. A change in its value by a mere 1 part in 10 to the 120th parts would cause the universe to expand too rapidly or too slowly. In either case, the universe would, again, be life-prohibiting. Or another example of fine-tuning: if the mass and energy of the early universe were not evenly distributed to an incomprehensible precision of 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd, the universe would be hostile to life of any kind. The fact is, our universe permits physical, interactive life only because these, and many other numbers, have been independently and exquisitely balanced on a razor's edge. Wherever physicists look, they see examples of fine-tuning. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. If anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features that the universe has, he's hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely. What is the best explanation for this astounding phenomenon? There are 3 live options. The fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. Which of these options is the most plausible? According to this alternative, the universe must be life-permitting. The precise values of these constants and quantities could not be otherwise. But is this plausible? Is a life-prohibiting universe impossible? Far from it. It's not only possible, it's far more likely than a life-permitting universe. The constants and quantities are not determined by the laws of nature. There's no reason or evidence to suggest that fine-tuning is necessary. How about chance? Did we just get really, 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 really lucky? No. The probabilities involved are so ridiculously remote as to put the fine-tuning well beyond the reach of chance. So, in an effort to keep this option alive, some have gone beyond empirical science and opted for a more speculative approach, known as the multiverse. They imagine a universe generator that cranks out such a vast number of universes that odds are life-permitting universes will eventually pop out. However, there's no scientific evidence for the existence of this multiverse. It cannot be detected, observed, measured, or proved. And the universe generator itself would require an enormous amount of fine-tuning. Furthermore, small patches of order are far more probable than big ones. So the most probable observable universe would be a small one inhabited by a single, simple observer. But what we actually observe is the very thing that we should least expect: a vast, spectacularly complex, highly ordered universe inhabited by billions of other observers. So even if the multiverse existed which is a moot point. It wouldn't do anything to explain the fine-tuning. Given the implausibility of physical necessity or chance, the best explanation for why the universe is fine-tuned for life may very well be it was designed that way. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect monkeyed with physics and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. There is for me powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge.
Okay, here's what I want to do. I want to give you, I want to give you a couple minutes at your tables there. Talk with your neighbor. What do you think about what we've just talked about? What questions do you have? What confuses you? What kind of objections or worries do you think someone might raise for what we've been talking about? Take a couple minutes and then we'll discuss together. Okay, well, let's get back together. I want to give you just a couple minutes here to feel free to ask questions, and then I want to get into our last argument for today. Anybody have any questions or comments or objections or worries? Yeah. What happens to them? Well, they would continue to exist just like any other universe would, right? Like our universe, imagine if it didn't have any life whatsoever. Like the universe existing doesn't depend on us existing, right?
At least in the way that I understand
Well, if the universe doesn't exist, obviously there's life in it, right? But you can imagine universes that do exist that expand so rapidly that stars can't form, which means it's not possible for there to be life in that universe. Such a universe would still exist. It's just there would be nobody in it. Does that make sense? And that's possible given the laws of nature that we have. And so that's how this stuff is calculated, is these scientists, they say, okay, well, what if we modified these numbers? What kind of a universe would we get? Would it be life permitting or not? And it turns out almost none of them would be life permitting. Yeah, but they would still exist. Yeah, good. Any other questions here or objections or? Eli, thank you.
Basically going against your own argument if you're saying God exists. So how would you give a rebuttal for that?
Really good. So that's going back to the argument from last week, right?
Yeah.
So whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. So notice, whatever begins to exist has a cause. What we would say is God didn't actually begin to exist. In fact, what we would need in order to account for the existence of the universe is a beginningless existent thing. Does that make sense? And so the argument actually is for there to be something that exists that doesn't have a beginning. And we looked last week at why we have a good reason to think that this being would have a mind as well, right? Because the only things I can think of that are non-physical and non-temporal, not in space and they're not in time, would be abstract objects and immaterial minds. But abstract objects don't cause things to happen, right? Like the number 2 doesn't eat your homework or something like that, right? That's not going to be a good excuse to your math teacher for why, you know, you don't have your homework. Because the number 2 can't actually do anything. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah, so I think I would go back to that argument there. But a common response to this one is to say, well, fine, who designed the designer, right? And there's a number of problems with this sort of response, and I actually have this on the handout. One of the common objections comes from, one of the people that gives this objection is Richard Dawkins. And there's a number of problems with this. One of them, I'll just give a couple of real quick ones. One of them is that an explanation can be a good explanation of something, even if you don't have an explanation for the explanation. Does that make sense? So let me give you an example. Suppose Sammy, Paris, and I, right, we go to Mars together, and we see this big biodome, and I, you know, Sammy says, wow, somebody must have made that. And I say, Sammy, what a dumb thing to say. Because, like, that, whatever it is that designed that would itself need an explanation, right? And so that's not a good explanation that you're giving me, that somebody designed that, because the designer would itself need a designer. Well, no, Sammy's explanation is a really good one, right? Maybe I don't know anything about who designed this thing, but I've got good reason to believe that somebody or something designed that thing. And so this design argument, I think, shows that there's got to be a designer. Now, what does it say about the nature of that designer? I think we're going to need to look at other arguments, like I think the Kalam cosmological argument, to learn more about what this designer is like. But what we do get is that there's an intentional creator of the universe. And that, to me, sounds an awful lot like God. Yeah. Yeah, good. All right, one last question, if anyone's got one. If not, we are running out of time, and I'm happy to jump into the final argument here. Okay. Well, then let's get into the final argument that I want to look at. So this is called the moral argument. And the moral argument goes like this. If God does not exist, then objective moral values and duties do not exist. And I'm going to explain what those are in just a minute here. So if God does not exist, then objective moral values and duties do not exist. Well, objective moral values and duties do exist. Therefore, God exists. This is another argument. It's a valid argument. Its form is what's called modus tollens. It's Latin for mode of taking. The structure of this argument is excellent. If the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. So the issue here is going to be, are the premises actually true? And so we're going to go through them. And I want to start with the second premise first, and then we'll go on to the first premise. So the second premise says objective moral values and duties do exist. So let's look at some support for this second premise. And the first question is, well, what does it mean to say that there are objective moral values and duties? So let's define some terms here. So first up, objective means true or false independently of what any human being thinks. And I really apologize to all of you. My handout, I accidentally left out or false. So you might want to write that in there as well. Objective, to say that something is objectively true, is to say that it's true and depends in no way on what human beings happen to think. So if we say the earth is spherical, we're saying something that's objectively true. If no one existed, it would still be true that the earth is spherical. In fact, if all of us believed the earth was flat, it would still be objectively true that the earth is spherical, right? We would all just be wrong about it. This is what it means for something to be objectively true. So the idea is moral claims, claims about what's right or wrong, these are objectively true. All right, second part here. What do we mean by values? Well, values have to do with whether something is good or bad. So we say kindness is good or love is good. Cruelty is bad. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about values. And then duties, have to do with whether something is right or wrong. So, for example, I see a kid drowning in a shallow fountain. I have a duty to rescue this kid from that shallow fountain. If I leave that kid to drown because Starbucks is just about to close and I really want my mocha frappuccino or whatever it is, that would be wrong, right? I have a duty to rescue this kid. And so the idea here is, look, we recognize there are some things that are really right or wrong no matter what anybody thinks. All right. Why think that there are such things as objective moral values and duties? Well, the answer here is that in our ordinary experience, we recognize moral values and duties that impose themselves upon us. We recognize that someone who leaves a kid in a shallow fountain to drown has acted immorally. We can see that that's true. Or a professor who gives a student an F because of their ethnicity or their skin color. We recognize that that is wrong and that's unjust. We see this to be true. And in fact, the majority of philosophers agree that morality is objective. There was a recent survey that was done in 2020 by Phil Papers, surveyed philosophers around the world, and 62% of all philosophers surveyed said, yeah, morality is objective. Within philosophy, that's incredible. Philosophers never agree about anything. In fact, in the same survey, philosophers didn't agree about what philosophy is or what the point of it is. They couldn't even agree on that. And yet they agree that morality is objective. We recognize these sorts of things. In fact, every semester in my ethics class, I have students take a survey, and I have that survey for you on your handout there. I'm not going to go through that survey. There's 9 questions. It's true or false, and I have students fill out the survey. I've been doing this for over a decade. I've had thousands of students complete this survey. Never, ever have I had a student that didn't say true to 6 or more of those statements, with the exception of one student who knew ahead of time the survey and intentionally tried to mess it up. We're gonna set that person aside. Every single person, thousands of students have taken this survey and they say true to 6 or more of those statements. Guess what? I think you might have had him in your class. The only view about morality that fits with saying true to six or more of the true to six or more of the statements on there is moral objectivism. If you think morality is culturally relative, you can't say true to six or more. If you think morality is subjective, you can't say true to six or more. If you think there is no such a thing as right or wrong, and it's just an illusion, a trick played on us by our genes to get us to cooperate with one another, that's a real view that people hold. You can't say true to six or more, yet everybody says true to six or more. And what this shows, I think, is that regardless of what people actually say they believe, when they're confronted with real life, they're really moral objectivists. And so I think this is our default position. And I think we should believe we're right about this, that morality is objective, unless we have some really good reason to think that we're mistaken. Without that, we should think that morality is objective. And the alternatives to moral objectivism are utter failures. Like, philosophers are widely agreed upon this. There's serious problems with all of these other views here. So we've got really good reason to think that morality is objective. Every semester, I'm always tempted, and I've never done it for obvious reasons, I'll tell you in a sec, to flunk a student who doesn't think that morality is objective and to say, I gave you an F because I don't like your hair color. I've never done it. I don't want to have that conversation, right, with the vice president of academic affairs. Look, it's just a philosophical exercise. Like, that's not going to work, I think. It's so tempting, though, right? Because guess what? If I did that to that student, they would immediately, they wouldn't say, oh, you violated the school policy. They'd say, what you did was wrong. This is unjust. We all recognize this. And I think some people have just fooled themselves into thinking that there is no such thing. All right. So let's go to premise one now. Premise one says, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Why think that that's the case? Well, if the universe is all that exists, then it's difficult to see how anything could really be right or wrong. If all of this is just a cosmic accident, how could anything be objectively right or wrong? It's not wrong for one atom to smash into another one, or for one rock to smash into another one, or for one animal to kill another animal. Why would it be wrong for one human being to kill another one? If God doesn't exist, there is no point to anything. So how could anything have moral value? Science, it studies nature, but nature itself is morally neutral. Moral values and duties, they're not discovered by scientific experiments. I got my bachelor's degree in biochemistry. I did 2 years of research in atmospheric chemistry, and I never once had a moral value show up in my mass spectrometer. Never saw one. Because it turns out that these aren't the sorts of things that the sciences can discover, because the universe itself, apart from God, is morally neutral. So the traditional view then that grounds morality is to say that something beyond nature has to ground morality. And God is goodness itself. He's the source and the standard of all goodness, and that's why morality is objective. That's the view. So, what are the alternatives then? If you're an atheist and you think morality is objective, because I didn't tell you this part, but the vast majority of philosophers in the survey, not only do they say morality is objective, they also said God doesn't exist. So, majority of philosophers were atheists. So, how do you account for objective morality if you're an atheist? Well, I want to give you a couple potential answers that are offered here. Let's see if I can get to it. Let's see. Okay, so what are the atheist alternatives? The first one is going to be naturalistic evolution. Here the idea is that moral values are just the byproduct of biological evolution and social conditioning. We happen to think that certain things are right and certain things are wrong, and that's just the result of how our genes have set us up so that we'll cooperate, so that we can just spread our genes further, and they'll go beyond us after we die. However, had things been different, well, then we'd think other things were wrong and other things were right. Notice this makes morality arbitrary. And so it turns out this isn't really an explanation for objective morality. It just says morality is not objective. It makes it just depend on how your genetics predisposed you or how your society predisposed you. And there's no real objective standard of right or wrong. So this actually isn't going to be an explanation of objective morality. It simply says there is no objective morality. Let's look at some other options then. Secular humanism. This view is going to say what's morally good is what promotes human flourishing. What's morally good is what promotes human flourishing, and what is bad is what detracts from human flourishing. Here's the problem with this view. Why think human flourishing is objectively good? Like, yes, we like it, I get it, but why think that it's objectively good? We could imagine some other species of animals, like cheetahs, all getting together. Like, why is it wrong to kill? They're like, it's wrong to kill things that are really, really fast. Well, being able to go really fast, that's arbitrary, right? What's so special about being fast? Likewise, what's so special about being a human being? What's so special about being able to reason? It's hard to see. In fact, there's a contemporary philosopher, his name is Peter Singer. He says, you know what? This is just speciesism. That is, it's like racism, right? Racism is preferring your own race above others, and it's just arbitrary. It's like racism, except instead of it being about race, it's about species. Oh, we just prefer our own species above others. But there's no real reason to say human beings are better than other animals. We just happen to prefer them. Without God, it's really hard to see how our preference for human beings isn't just speciesism. There's no reason to think human flourishing is better than anything else on atheism. The third and final option here is atheistic moral Platonism. And what this says is objective moral values exist as abstract objects, but they're not grounded in God. They just exist. So there's this idea in philosophy that there's this realm of the forms. It's called Plato's heaven. These are Platonic forms. And so things like justice itself just exists as this abstract object in the realm of Platonic forms. And things like kindness or cruelty also as abstract objects exist. And some philosophers say, well, that's what makes things right or wrong. There's several problems with this. First, it's really hard to understand how these immaterial objects could really exist independently of the physical world, right? They don't depend on human beings in any way. They don't depend on God. So like, where are they? How exactly do these things exist? But second of all, suppose such things really do exist. What do they have to do with us? Why is it that some of these things apply to me and other ones don't, right? Like, why am I supposed to live in line with justice rather than selfishness? Those are both Platonic forms that are up there. Why live in alignment with kindness rather than cruelty? Again, those both are up there. So why is it that I should live in line with one over the other? And then finally, on atheism, how could I ever come to know of such things, right? These are non-physical things. They're immaterial. They have no causal powers at all. So how, on evolutionary theory, could I ever come to know such things? That's extremely unlikely. And so again, it's really hard to see how we could give any sort of grounding for objective moral truth apart from God. And so what we're left with then is our argument here. If God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Objective moral values and duties, they do exist. Therefore, God exists. What I want to do is wrap up here. I'll show my short video, and then I'll give you a minute or two to ask questions.
Can you be good without God? Let's find out. Absolutely astounding. There you have it. Undeniable proof that you can be good without believing in God. But wait. The question isn't, can you be good without believing in God? The question is, can you be good without God? See, here's the problem. If there is no God, what basis remains for objective good or bad, right or wrong? If God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. And here's why. without some objective reference point, we have no way of saying that something is really up or down. God's nature provides an objective reference point for moral values. It's the standard against which all actions and decisions are measured. But if there's no God, there's no objective reference point. All we're left with is one person's viewpoint, which is no more valid than anyone else's viewpoint. This kind of morality is subjective, not objective. It's like a preference for strawberry ice cream. The preference is in the subject, not the object. So it doesn't apply to other people. In the same way, subjective morality applies only to the subject. It's not valid or binding for anyone else. So, in a world without God, there can be no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. God has expressed his moral nature to us as commands. These provide the basis for moral duties. For example, God's essential attribute of love is expressed in his command to love your neighbor as yourself. This command provides a foundation upon which we can affirm the objective goodness of generosity, self-sacrifice, and equality. And we can condemn as objectively evil greed, abuse, and discrimination. This raises a problem. Is something good just because God wills it, or does God will something because it is good? The answer is neither one. Rather, God wills something because he is good. God is the standard of moral values, just as a live musical performance is the standard for a high-fidelity recording.
Without your love.
The more a recording sounds like the original, the better it is. Likewise, the more closely a moral action conforms to God's nature, the better it is. But if atheism is true, there is no ultimate standard. So there can be no moral obligations or duties. Who or what lays such duties upon us? No one. Remember, for the atheist, humans are just accidents of nature, highly evolved animals. But animals have no moral obligations to one another. When a cat kills a mouse, it hasn't done anything morally wrong. The cat's just being a cat. If God doesn't exist, we should view human behavior in the same way. No action should be considered morally right or wrong. But the problem is, good and bad, right and wrong, do exist. Just as our sense experience convinces us that the physical world is objectively real, our moral experience convinces us that moral values are objectively real. Every time you say, "Hey, that's not fair, that's wrong, that's an injustice," you affirm your belief in the existence of objective morals. We're well aware that child abuse, racial discrimination, and terrorism are wrong for everybody, always. Is this just a personal preference or opinion? No. The man who says that it is morally acceptable to rape little children is just as mistaken as the man who says 2 + 2 = 5. What all this amounts to then is a moral argument for the existence of God. If God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. But objective moral values and duties do exist. Therefore, God exists. Atheism fails to provide a foundation for the moral reality every one of us experiences every day. In fact, the existence of objective morality points us directly to the existence of God.
Okay, we are almost out of time, so I'm going to go ahead and just open it up to you. What kinds of questions do you have here? Or comments or objections? Anything at all? Give you a few seconds here to ask some questions. If you have them about any of the stuff we've talked about today, feel free to ask. Otherwise, I'll wrap up for tonight here. But I do want to give you a chance to ask me questions. No questions? Okay. Well then, we've looked at three arguments for the existence of God. What have we shown here? Well, we have shown that there exists a being that is spaceless, does not exist in space, is timeless, is uncaused, is immensely powerful, is an immaterial mind who intentionally created and designed the universe, and is morally good. That sure sounds a lot like God. And what we're going to do next week is we're going to look at a really common argument against the existence of God. This is known as the problem of evil. And then we're going to look at what I think is one of the best responses to the problem of evil, and that is the resurrection of Jesus. And we're going to look at some reasons for thinking that Jesus actually rose from the dead. Thank you again for coming tonight. It was good to see all of you. If you have any questions, feel free to stick around and ask. Otherwise, I'll see you all next week.